Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, May 16, 2017, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, we'll hear a telephone on the legacy of the Spokio v. Robbins decision, 1 year later. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today we are happy to have with us Jeffrey S. Jacobson, partner at Kelly, Dry & Warren, and Alan Charles Rawl, partner at Sidley Austin. I will turn it over to Alan to get us started. After opening remarks, we'll go to audience question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us. The floor is yours.
Thanks, Laura, and thanks for everybody for joining the Federalist Society exactly 1 year after the Supreme Court decided the Spokio decision on standing. And what we're going to do today is discuss a little bit about why this case is what it's about and why it's important. I'll talk about some of the emerging and indeed conflicting cases that have evolved in the aftermath of Spokio, then talk about some relevant policy issues before turning it over to Jeff for his assessment of what the case means and what it doesn't, and also we'll follow up with some back and forth and then take questions from the listeners. So, as I mentioned, it was exactly a year ago that the Supreme Court handed down its decision, which involved an alleged violation of the Fair Credit Reporting Act, sometimes pronounced as FCRA, in a case where there was an allegation of a technical violation, but without any without consideration by the Ninth Circuit as to whether there had been an actual concrete injury or harm that was sufficient to establish a constitutional Article III standing of a case or controversy. So FCRA is a statute that stipulates certain procedural substantive requirements. It's significant that in addition to stipulating what's required under the statute, it also provides a private right of action, and it authorizes statutory damages for violations of those requirements. As most relevant to the case at hand in Spokio, FCRA required consumer reporting agencies, and Spokio in that case was, for purposes of the litigation at that stage, assumed to be a consumer reporting agency. Spokio describes itself as an online people search engine. But FCRA requires covered entities to, quote, follow reasonable procedures to assure maximum possible accuracy, close quote, of consumer reports. And that's the statutory standard at issue. And maybe the wording of that was relevant to the decision and will turn out, as we see the trend in evolving cases, possibly the relative specificity or non-specificity of the congressional stipulation of a statutory requirement may prove to be relevant. In any event, I think one can't talk about the Spokio decision without talking about the allegation, the specific factual allegations. Mr. Robbins claimed that Spokio had violated his rights under the Fair Credit Reporting Act by inaccurately reporting that he was a wealthy, married man with children who held a graduate degree, when in fact he was unmarried, out of work, didn't reside at a stable address, didn't have a graduate degree, and it was his argument that his injury comprised his lessened chances of employment for jobs for which he was actually qualified. In other words, that he would look too good to potential employers and not get hired based on his actual qualifications and the facts associated with him. So there may be some argument here that perhaps the court didn't take his allegations too seriously, but the Ninth Circuit had considered whether or not there was a particularized injury to Mr. Robinson, but not whether the injury he claimed was concrete for purposes of standing, and the Supreme Court remanded back to the Ninth Circuit because it found that the mere allegation of a statutory violation, even one which held a private right of action and the possibility of statutory damages, that nonetheless it doesn't constitute automatic right to standing. Justice Alito wrote the opinion for the court, and he said that Article III standing requires concrete injury even in the context of a statutory violation. At the same time, though, he acknowledged that the violation of a procedural right can be sufficient in some circumstances to constitute injury in fact. So basically what the court is saying, courts of appeals and district courts, you have to look at these claimed statutory violations and the resulting injury hard, but we're not going to tell you very clearly which way you have to come out, because in some cases it will be sufficient and in other cases it won't. What the court did say, it did provide guidance. It said that bare, in its words, bare or immaterial procedural violations won't suffice. And the upshot really is that this should enhance the ability of companies that are defending lawsuits under privacy, data security, informational rights statutes, perhaps other consumer protection statutes, to defend against allegations that, in the words of the Supreme Court in Spokio, where the plaintiff's interests appear so abstract, ethereal, or implausible as to appear unreal. The Supreme Court, though, and part of the resulting disarray, perhaps, in the lower courts trying to interpret Spokio, did say that intangible injuries can be real, they can be concrete, they can give rise to standing, but only where they pose some de facto risk of harm to the plaintiff. And the court again conceded that concrete injuries are not synonymous with tangible injuries, but it did observe, the court observed, that tangible injuries are perhaps easier to recognize than intangible injuries. The court gave some examples of intangible injuries that could give rise to standing, First Amendment interests like free speech, free exercise of religion, tort injuries involving libel or slander, significantly, informational procedural cases where a plaintiff's inability to obtain information, for example, about voter or federal advisory committee data, was at issue. But again, the court stressed that to be concrete, the injuries actually had to exist and be de facto. So what clearly the court is saying that Congress has some power, but not plenary power, to define or elevate injuries essentially make the analysis of how concrete the injury is kind of dispensable or at least easier to decide. The Supreme Court said that Congress can provide, in the words of the Supreme Court, instructive and important guidance in identifying legally cognizable intangible harms, but that the Constitution nonetheless limited the power of Congress to grant standing. Significantly and specifically, the court said that not all inaccuracies cause harm or present material risk of harm. They gave the example of, for example, the court said, it's difficult to imagine how the dissemination of an incorrect zip code without more could work any concrete harm. The court then noted that because the doctrine of standing evolves from the case or controversy requirement, that it's necessarily grounded in historical practice under the Constitution, and the courts would look for the sufficiency of allegations of harm and sufficiency of concreteness as to whether there's a close relationship to a harm that's traditionally been regarded as providing a basis for a lawsuit in English or American courts. So turning now to kind of the emerging and diverging views, the conflict in the case law that I mentioned earlier, there have been numerous cases holding that a violation of a statutory procedural right, such as a privacy right, is not sufficient without some concrete consequence. So just looking at some notable Court of Appeals decisions, there was in the D.C. Circuit, Hancock v. Urban Outfitters. court held that the collection of address information in alleged violation of the District of Columbia's Consumer Identification Information Act was not a sufficiently concrete injury in the absence of some allegation that plaintiff had suffered some injury apart from the collection of the information itself. This case provides an opportunity to point out that the statutory violations that could be at issue under the court's Spokio ruling pertains both to federal statutes and state statutes. If the case is filed in a federal court, the Sixth Circuit in Galleria versus Nationwide Mutual Insurance held in a data breach case that the theft by hackers of Social Security and driver's license numbers and other sensitive personal information was not a sufficient injury under the Fair Credit Reporting Act, so that's another case. The Eighth Circuit held that the retention of personally identifiable information under the Cable Communications Policy Act without more doesn't constitute a concrete injury. But other cases have come out the other way in the courts of appeals. The Third Circuit, in a case under the Video Privacy Protection Act, in a case called In Re Nickelodeon Consumer Privacy Litigation, held that the defendant had unlawfully collected information about online video viewing history through cookies, and that the disclosure of that information to third parties was a de facto harm under the Video Privacy Protection Act, regardless of any actual impact or harm alleged by the individual video viewers. Third Circuit also, in a data breach case called Horizon Healthcare this year, held that the information of about 839 insureds was on stolen laptops, and the allegation was that the Fair Credit Reporting Act was violated because the information was ostensibly "quote unquote" furnished to the people who stole the laptops. The court rejected an argument that Spokio required dismissal, and the court here said that Spokio didn't really change the law and did not erect new barriers preventing Congress from identifying a new cause of action based on intangible harm. And the court said, the Third Circuit, clearly the statute illustrates Congress believed the violation of the Fair Credit Reporting Act, the same statute as at issue in Spokio, caused concrete harm to consumers. Now, the 11th Circuit, in a case called Church versus Accretive Health in July of 2016, held that a borrower who received a debt collection letter under the Fair Debt Collections Practices Act that didn't contain certain required information disclosures, that this was a concrete injury, even in the absence of any, you know, more tangible harm. The court said, the 11th Circuit, that Congress had created a new right to receive required information disclosures. And remember, Spokio did say that the right to receive certain information in connection with federal advisory committees or federal election requirements, that could be an intangible right that would give rise to injury. The Ninth Circuit also found that under the Telephone Consumer Protection Act, the receipt of spam texts from a gym in a case called Van Patten versus Vertical Fitness, that notwithstanding any the absence of any tangible harm being alleged, that the TCPA right not to receive spam text was sufficient. I mentioned the 11th Circuit in the case Church v. Accretive Health under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. The case said that the failure to get a notice with the required information in and of itself was a statutory violation that gave rise to standing. But just to demonstrate what confusion there is in this area, or at least the opportunity for conflicting decisions. Just 2 weeks ago, on May 2nd, the 11th Circuit en banc declined to reconsider a panel decision that had dismissed a proposed class action against Citi Mortgage under a New York law, which had, so the panel had dismissed the class action alleging a mere violation of a technical requirement under New York law. The case was Nick Law against Citi Mortgage, and the allegation was that the bank had violated New York's real property laws by failing to record satisfaction of a mortgage within 90 days of the consumer paying it off, as was required by the state law. The panel dismissed the case. The majority of the 11th Circuit, notwithstanding the Church v. Accretive Health decision, declined to reconsider it. One judge dissented, Beverly Martin. She said that the New York statutes at issue give property owners a certain right to have truthful information posted about their property, and that the New York legislature had required this 90-day disclosure to address what Judge Martin described as serious harms that can befall property owners when satisfaction of their mortgages are not timely recorded, such as clouded titles and the ability of the individuals to get credit or transfer property. In contrast, the judges on the panel who expressed themselves on the rehearing request, they said that to the extent that there was any risk of future harm, it was eliminated years before the plaintiff filed the lawsuit when the bank had recorded satisfaction of the mortgage. So in other words, the statute in New York required a 90-day recording of the satisfaction of the mortgage. It didn't take place within 90 days, but ultimately it was done, and the majority judges were of the view that to the extent there was any harm, it had long since failed to materialize and thus disappeared. So we can see, looking at the kind of the policy dynamic or policy dilemma that we're in, that despite considerable inconsistency in the decisions, to say the least, what is clear is that courts are taking a harder look at the injury alleged in cases even where there is a statutory requirement and a statutory violation of those requirements can be alleged. So Spokio has succeeded in that regard in getting courts to take a harder look, even though they're not always coming out the same way. So there is a fact-specific inquiry that is taking place in cases that are looking at these alleged statutory violations. To the extent that sensitive data is alleged to be involved, plaintiffs may be more likely, although not certain, as I noted earlier, to establish concrete injury even in the absence of an economic loss. And the court in Spokio and in the remand by the Supreme Court and in the separate opinions, concurring opinions of Justice Thomas and Ginsburg on the question of the legal standard, they clearly is a consensus that carefully individualized analysis is required of the informational or procedural or technical statutory violation of how it affects the plaintiff. So maybe the distinction in Spokio and what constitutes a bare technical violation and an immaterial one, or what is a concrete violation, is whether the alleged violative conduct goes to the heart of the right that Congress intended to create. Recall that the court in Spokio said Congress is well positioned to identify intangible harms that meet Article III requirements, and Congress does have the power, the court said, to define injuries and articulate chains of causation that will give rise to a case or controversy when none existed before. So, what do courts look at? What should courts look at? How specific was Congress about the requirement in question? What did Congress say? How did they express themselves with regard to the harm they're trying to protect individuals against? And then, of course, how close is the allegation of injury to a traditional violation under U.S. or English law? It's worth noting that in Justice Thomas's concurrence in Spokio, he wrote separately to explain his view that modern standing doctrine, one of the roles that it plays is to ensure that courts don't become entangled in disputes that are essentially political in nature. He said that where public rights are involved, namely duties owed to the community at large, it's generally only the government that can sue to enforce the obligation. This may be a relevant distinction to bear in mind, that in certain technical violations, maybe the consumer protection agencies, for example, the Federal Trade Commission or the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau or state attorneys general, that maybe enforcement should be delegated to those agencies rather than to private enforcement. But again, I'll close by noting that the court did acknowledge, did concede that Congress has the power to define and elevate injuries, and that it can provide instructive and important guidance as to identifying when intangible harm should be legally cognizable for standing purposes. With that, I'll turn it over to Jeff for his further assessment and discussion of what Spokio means and doesn't mean.
Thanks very much, Alan. As we consider the legacy of Spokio, I think it's important to remember that, and we can judge this by the sheer number and volume of amicus briefs on both sides, this case had the potential to be a complete disaster for one side or the other in the class action wars. If it had been a total win for the defense bar, the Supreme Court would have agreed with the position of the Chamber of Commerce that tangible injury means tangible injury. It means some kind of monetary harm, and you can't sue without it. But the Supreme Court explicitly disagreed with that, saying that concrete harm does not have to be tangible harm. On the other hand, it could have been a complete disaster for the defense bar if the Supreme Court had gone along with the Ninth Circuit and basically held that any statutory violation gives rise to standing. And so, interestingly, a year later, this case has not even resolved the dispute between Spokio and Robbins. Those two continue to beat each other about the head with two-by-fours. There is still a vehement disagreement between the sides in Spokio itself as to whether or not Mr. Robbins has the standing required by the Supreme Court's decision, and that case may go on for quite a while. So a year later, we have some, as Alan quite cogently pointed out, we have some clarity. We know, for example, that if someone is merely saying you failed to provide me with information that I was required to get, but they did not suffer any harm flowing from that of the type that Congress intended to protect, that informational injury is not enough. We know, at least with some degree of certainty, that a plaintiff's lawyer cannot roam the countryside looking for a bare procedural violation, find somebody who allegedly suffered from it, and bring a suit under it. But as we think about what the Supreme Court meant when it said that concrete harm does not have to be tangible harm, I want to offer for everyone's consideration two real-world circumstances. One did not end up in a case, and one did. The one that's merely a hypothetical case is the hypothetical case of Robert Bork against Potomac Video. If we can imagine a world in which Congress had been prescient enough to figure out what might happen to Judge Bork and had passed the Video Privacy Protection Act a year or two earlier, and an intrepid reporter goes to Judge Bork's video store, asks for his rental records, and discloses them in violation of the Video Privacy Protection Act, Judge Bork would not have suffered any monetary harm from that, nor would he really have suffered any other harm except for the violation. I don't think that those of us on this call would say that the video rental record issue was a material impact on Judge Bork's confirmation hearings. So the question is, if Judge Bork suffered exactly the harm that Congress sought to protect in the Video Privacy Protection Act, the video store acted toward him in exactly the way Congress prohibited, and Judge Bork's privacy was violated in exactly the way that Congress intended to protect, would Judge Bork have had standing in that circumstance to bring suit? We can all wonder what Judge Bork himself would say about that. I actually read his standing decisions in preparation for this call. I suspect he might have said that there was no standing. But I think that the 400-some decisions post-Spokio later we can conclude with some degree of certainty that Judge Bork would be found to have standing even absent any kind of monetary or real-world impactful harm beyond the invasion of his privacy. The second situation that is a real-world case involves a woman by the name of Melody Stoops. Ms. Stoops learned about the Telephone Consumer Protection Act, and she thought that this might be a good way to generate income for herself. So she researched where in America consumers were likely to be defaulting on credit card and other consumer debt. She went out and bought 35 prepaid cell phones and had the phone company assign her telephone numbers from those Florida zip codes that she thought would be most likely to have defaulting debtors, even though she lived in Pennsylvania. And everywhere she went, including driving in her car, she carried around a box with these 35 phones. And every time the phone rang, one of the phones rang, and it was from some robocaller, usually a debt collector, she created a log and called her lawyer and filed a lawsuit. And she filed quite a lot of lawsuits. One day, she had the misfortune of suing Wells Fargo in the Western District of Pennsylvania. And Wells Fargo said, "I'm sorry, but she does not fall within the zone of interest that Congress sought to protect when it passed the TCPA. Yes, her phone rang, but that was not what Congress did not intend to allow people to generate a business with this." The Stoops opinion in Stoops against Wells Fargo Bank spent its first number of pages affirming that Ms. Stoops did fall within the zone of interest protected, I'm sorry, that she did have standing under the TCPA, and that what Wells Fargo did in this circumstance in calling her without her consent arguably violated the TCPA. But the court nevertheless dismissed her claim on summary judgment because it found that, sorry, Congress really did not intend, when it tried to protect people from having their privacy invaded with nuisance calls, it did not intend to let people like Melody Stoops generate a business out of this. And the Stoops situation is kind of so ridiculous that you would have to make it up if it didn't exist, because it's the kind of situation that those of us in the defense bar go into court and say, this is why the standing requirement exists. This person suffered no harm. This is a pure gotcha, and this case does not belong in court. Now, Stoops is unique. Not everybody gets 35 prepaid cell phones and drives around with them in her car, but it is illustrative of a problem that those of us who deal with statutes like the Video Privacy Protection Act and the Telephone Consumer Protection Act deal with all the time. So just as one example, imagine you have a putative class action and under the Telephone Consumer Protection Act, and you have people in that class who would have who your call records show you tried to call, but it turns out that their phone was off, their phone was in their locker, they didn't hear it ring. They suffered no intrusion, no nuisance. They didn't even know you tried to call them. Do they have a claim under the TCPA simply because their number appears on your call records? Or can you defeat class certification on the theory that your call records reflect some people whose phone might have rung in a manner that violated, that intruded on their privacy rights, but other people on the list did not? These are questions that the courts still are having. They haven't quite wrestled with them yet. The cases have not marched far enough down the tracks that we have any real guidance as to what Spokio means for class certification. But the last point that I want to get out there before Alan and I have our dialogue and then we open it up for questions is I want to tell the story of cases that were filed in New Jersey under a statute that many of you will have heard of called the Truth in Consumer Contract Warranty and Notice Act, where basically in New Jersey you cannot put a provision in a contract that violates a clearly established New Jersey law, whatever that means. And it provides that an aggrieved consumer, whatever that means, can sue for $100. So a number of these cases were filed in federal court, and they might have been defended on the grounds that consumers who didn't read the provision in question or had other deficiencies in their claim were not aggrieved and therefore could not sue. Many defendants, however, chose to bring Spokio motions on cases brought in federal court, saying that these consumers who didn't read the contract or did not have any harm flowing from it lack standing under Spokio. And those motions won. And, you know, so that a number of the cases where Spokio was raised over the past year, the courts agreed and threw the cases out of federal court. The problem is, at least in theory, it hasn't happened yet in practice that I'm aware of, but it certainly could happen in theory, a dismissal on Spokio grounds in cases like that would be no bar to the plaintiffs at least attempting to bring to replead exactly the same cases in state court. And then you would have – it would be difficult, if not impossible, to allege that the Class Action Fairness Act is satisfied because, as we've seen in at least one case, one cannot invoke federal jurisdiction and then seek remand on the basis that federal jurisdiction is lacking. You can get sanctioned for that. So Spokio is a wonderful tool. It is something that those of us in the defense bar should have in the bag, ready to pull out. But it's one that should be, in my view at least, used somewhat more sparingly perhaps than it has been, at least until we get a little bit more clarity as to what the case does and does not mean. Because if you pull it out at the wrong time, it could end up actually, at least potentially, harming the client's interest in the long run. Because number one, in terms of the client's own case, it may not be in the client's long run interest to win a case on Spokio grounds because it may not be the end of the matter. And then there's also the question of basically trying to shape this law in a manner that is most conducive to what our clients in general are trying to achieve. And that means kind of husbanding these decisions and not forcing courts to decide that standing is not present in cases where their inclination, using the Bork example, is to find that it does exist. So I love this. I particularly love it as a cautionary tale in cases like Stoops and for what it might mean to class certification. But I, at least speaking just for myself, I'm a little bit cautious about what it means in general, because as the Spokio and Robbins themselves illustrate, it's a case that both sides walked away from thinking they won, or at least didn't lose. So, Alan, what thousand things I've just said do you disagree with?
I think that you've I love the Judge Bork thought exercise there. Which way would he come out on the case that Congress was clearly trying to protect future Judge Borks from having their private records, even if there was nothing in those records that was damaging, detrimental, embarrassing, or used for improper purposes. So I love that thought exercise. I think that you're absolutely right, in my view, that it was a disaster for neither side, and neither side is a clear winner. Is able to rely on Spokio unequivocally, especially since the courts of appeals and district courts have come out in both directions. But I would say that the defense side is certainly, in my view, I'm interested if you agree, has the stronger grounds for satisfaction, if not celebration, in Spokio, because really what the court is signaling that Congress can only be instructive and provide guidance on when plaintiffs have standing and cannot be decisive about it, which I would say, even in statutes where Congress has said, here's what's specifically required, here is the private right of action to allow plaintiffs to sue, to enforce those requirements. And by the way, in the event that the actual damages are difficult to ascertain, we're going to provide for statutory damages. The Supreme Court is saying that notwithstanding all of that from Congress, it's still not good enough, and courts have to take a careful, individualized, probing review of the allegations at hand. So I think that has to be viewed as more favorable to the defense side than the plaintiff side. I will say that what this area of law really is addressing somewhat without full resolution, without being completely satisfying, is really what are the non-pecuniary, the intangible harms that result from privacy or informational requirements and the right of people to be free of harms to their dignity, their autonomy, their ability to control information about themselves. I would say that where the alleged informational injury constitutes real embarrassment or reputational harm, that it will be fairly easy going forward for a consensus to be established that those are concrete injuries. But what about when it's your dignity or your autonomy, your ability to control information, the fact that you feel creeped out? The courts are really not yet grappling with these issues. In one case where Spokio was alleged in the Fourth Circuit in February of this year, Beck versus McDonald, which did involve statutory allegations under the Federal Privacy Act. This involved a data breach at the Veterans Affairs Department. The Privacy Act was alleged, which requires information to be personal information to be protected, as well as the Administrative Procedure Act. The court said Spokio wasn't controlling there, but it did because the plaintiffs didn't say that the allegations of harm under the Privacy Act were sufficient to constitute Article III injury by itself. But the court did undertake an analysis of the Privacy Act, where the Supreme Court has said that notwithstanding Congress's recitals as to its desire to protect American citizens, American persons from embarrassment and that sort of injury, the court said that under the Privacy Act, only pecuniary harm is actionable. It said that in FAA versus Cooper, and said actual damages in an earlier case, Doe v. Chow, were required, and later it construed actual damages and in the context of a case against a federal agency where federal money would be involved, that only pecuniary damages could be recovered from. But there's going to, you know, come a time where the courts are really going to grapple with just how far can the intangible interests in protecting privacy, where embarrassment and reputation or medical information that could be so sensitive as to be uniformly viewed as concrete harm, you know, the courts are going to have to grapple with that. So I'll turn it back over to Jeff for his reaction.
I think I agree with most of that. I certainly agree that the defense bar has much more to celebrate with Spokio than the plaintiff's bar does, if for no other reason than that because the alternative would have been so awful. If it truly were the case that any kind of a statutory violation gives rise to standing, that would have been as bad as the Chamber of Commerce and the other amici predicted. I guess the one – it's not really disagreement, but maybe just a gloss on what you were saying, Alan, is – the decisions so far, at least the ones that I'm most familiar with, have – when they've thought about this as a separation of powers issue, they're not thinking about it so much as whether Congress can define something as harm and give people a private right of action to sue under it if that was their explicit intent to define harm as, for example, the intrusive call or the disclosure of your video records or, in the future, the disclosure of your medical records. It was more a question of it's up to the executive to roam the countryside and look for pure legal violations to prosecute, and that it is not for courts to allow individual citizens to come in and usurp the role of the executive by bringing, in a way that is something less than fully adversarial, a claim of a bare procedural violation untethered to particular harm. So I think that Congress probably, under this decision, has not unlimited by any stretch, but fairly broad ability to give citizens standing when they have suffered what Congress can adequately define as a harm. Congress can't allocate to the citizenry the ability to go and roam the countryside policing for generalized violations, but as evidenced by the outrage that generated the Telephone Consumer Protection Act, my God, my phone won't stop ringing, Congress can define that intrusion into your home as something that you can sue over. And that's at least what the post-Spokio courts have held, that whereas in the first few months after Spokio, some courts said, well, or at least some plaintiffs believed that they had to allege, oh, my battery was depleted by 1/1,000,000th of a percent because the phone rang, or some other kind of purely invented tangible harm. Plaintiffs, it seems, have become a little bit more comfortable just saying, look, Congress tried to protect me against my phone ringing when I didn't want it to, and I suffered that harm, and courts have gone along with that and not required the made-up monetary harm that people were trying to get by with 11 months ago.
Yep. Well, I think that's a very correct and astute analysis. I would say that I'd like to think that there is a leitmotif or a theme running under these cases. I'm going to say I'd like to say it, but I don't think it's true yet. That the Supreme Court and ultimately courts of appeals and district courts are going to expect and require more clearly is that Congress, prescribe the harm and the violation that it intends with greater specificity and clarity. And I agree with you, Jeff, on the TCPA, that in those cases, as ridiculous as many of the outcomes in these cases,
and brother, are they ridiculous?
And they are really ridiculous. But unfortunately, for maybe all concerned, I think the satisfaction there is going to have to come from Congress, because Congress is the one that caused this ridiculous state of affairs, where basically this statute really permits abusive litigation. But one of the takeaways, perhaps from Justice Thomas's concurrence in Spokio, focusing on the separation of powers issue, is that maybe the Supreme Court will come to require Congress to speak in general with greater clarity and specificity, and not allow in other cases as much discretion, one, to trial judges and other judges, and two, and perhaps just in the interest of finding a dialectic here with you to make it more interesting, even though I agree with what you said about the agencies roaming to handle some of these cases rather than private plaintiffs, and that maybe the Supreme Court will require more specific delegation to agencies rather than, under the Chevron doctrine, basically going along with whatever reasonable interpretation an agency might want to undertake to fill interstices where Congress has really spoken very ambiguously and not prescribed the right in question or the injury in question with any precision. Maybe the courts are going to hold Congress itself more accountable to speak with clarity and precision. In the case of TCPA as it stands today, perhaps one would say Congress's clarity there is unfortunate. And but again, under separation of powers analysis, perhaps one needs to go back to Congress to rectify that and get relief.
I think that's a great place to open it up to questions, because I think that really highlights what Spokio was not, which was that Spokio was not the court saving Congress from the consequences of perhaps unwise choices. And to say that it's going to be up to Congress to fix those kinds of mistakes, because the court was not going to create a requirement of damages beyond what Congress itself purported to require.
Great. Let's go to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. As we wait for the first question, I'll make a brief announcement. Our next Teleform conference call is scheduled for Friday, May 19th. That call will feature Thomas M. Johnson, Jr., Deputy Solicitor General of West Virginia, to discuss the legal challenge to the President's executive order on reducing regulation and controlling regulatory costs. A reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming telephone calls. You can also consult the full schedule of our upcoming telephone conference calls on the Federalist Society's website, fedsoc.org. Also available there are podcasts of previously recorded telephone calls you may have missed. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any questions. Here we go. Let's go to our first question.
Yes, hi, gentlemen. You know, I don't think that the answer is to get Congress to define the injuries as much as for the plaintiff to say that he was injured. And, you know, if you look at Robbins, he never really said how he was injured. He gave a lot of hypotheticals. Well, if I was looking for a job, if I was looking for a wife, but he never said that he was actually doing any of those things. So the fact that Congress is trying to prevent an injury does not mean that plaintiff actually suffered the injury. And I seem to recall in the previous case that was ultimately dismissed on the same issue, the First American versus Edwards. I remember Justice Breyer giving a hypothetical where he said, well, let's say it's my grandmother, she's lonely and she gets cold calls. She loves these cold calls. And, you know, can she actually claim she was injured? I mean, if I get a cold call and I just love goofing on the guy, I get immense pleasure out of it. Can I then go in and also sue at the same time? And I think that the courts have been lax in pressing the plaintiffs to say how they were injured, not just point to the statute. So I wonder what you thought about that.
So this is Jeff. I agree with you on basically all parts of your question and observation. I think that I think and hope that the Spokio case will come out that way. I think that it's been a tough road for Robbins to articulate harm in his case. But I think that with regard to the TCPA, I think that the hypothetical grandmother or the hypothetical person who enjoys goofing on the callers is unlikely to be a plaintiff, whereas the people who have brought suits have basically been alleging that they were bothered. I didn't want my phone to ring. I didn't want to get that text message. And they have believed that saying my phone rang in a manner that intruded on my privacy is enough. And as the statistics that we've all been reading about in the past couple of days celebrating or lamenting the one-year anniversary have shown, most cases under the Telephone Consumer Protection Act have found standing on allegations exactly like that. And so all I was trying to say a few minutes ago is that if Congress really wants people to have experienced more actual harm than getting perhaps one phone call or two phone calls that the caller didn't realize that it was a wrong number, before they can sue for $500 to $1,500 per call, Congress needs to impose a higher hurdle, because so far courts are saying it's enough if the person says my privacy was intruded on by that call.
This is Alan. What I would note there first is with regard to the Breyer hypothetical on the enjoyment or despisement of these cold telephone calls, I think that one of the most popular acts that government has taken in recent years was the Federal Trade Commission, also joined by the Federal Communications Commission. The FTC chair at the time, Tim Muris, who's just joined me here at Sidley, it was one of his showcase reforms, which was to establish the Do Not Call Registry as a matter of FTC regulation, and later it was embodied in law. It apparently, the polling indicates that it was really one of the most popular consumer protection actions that the government has ever taken. So there's always an outlier, and it may be Justice Breyer's relative but evidently people really don't like getting those calls. And when there was a time that people had fax machines at home, if anybody remembers that, I think I had one, if not two, at some point.
There are still a lot of TCPA fax cases. You wouldn't believe it.
I know, but at the time when people had those fax machines in their homes, and you'd get a ring in the middle of the night, and it was very annoying. And actually, the question of ink and paper, might have been relevant. But one of the points that I would say on Robbins in the Spokio case and the Fair Credit Reporting Act's obligation to for consumer reporting agencies to undertake reasonable procedures to ensure, fair and accurate disclosures. That's a good principle to abide by, but it was not all that specific. In contrast with other cases where the procedural violation was, you have a right to receive certain information in a certain kind of debt collection letter, or you have a right to a recordation of your payment of your mortgage within 90 days. That's very specific, and I could see outcomes depending perhaps on the degree of specificity in the statutory right that the Congress or state legislature will have established. In connection with whether Mr. Robbins can establish that, in fact, he didn't get a job or didn't find a wife because of Spokio's allegedly inaccurate information about him, he may not be able to establish that, and maybe the case ought to founder on his, on his own inability to allege that. And maybe that's exactly going back to Jeff's point about and Justice Thomas's point about who should be bringing these actions. Should it be private plaintiffs as class actions, or should it be government agencies? And the Federal Trade Commission, for example, which enforces many of these consumer protection statutes, they take the position that they are, under their statute, required only to establish likely harm for the population in general, not the occurrence of actual past harm to individuals. And that's a distinction that one could bear in mind. If an alleged consumer reporting agency has not established reasonable procedures to ensure fair and accurate in general, even though no individual can demonstrate or allege that he or she has experienced some concrete harm as a result of the allegedly inaccurate information, maybe that's a case then for the Federal Trade Commission. If the reasonable procedures aren't there, or if there's a practice of publicizing inaccurate information, maybe that's a distinction between what should be properly a class action and what should properly be kind of a regulatory action where the statutory standards are not satisfied, sort of in gross, if you will.
Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any questions, I'll ask one of my own. Do you think that a similar case to Spokio will make it up to the Supreme Court soon, or do you think the real action will all be taken in Congress, like you mentioned?
Alan, you want to take that one first?
I think that I think ultimately the Supreme Court is going to get a privacy action which addresses issues that are where the intangible privacy interest is at issue, and whether there's a chilling effect on people's behavior. In the Clapper case itself, which was a standing case in a national security context, where attorneys for who were representing individuals who might have some reasonable basis to believe they were subject to surveillance, and the court, and they alleged that the conversations and their attorney-client communications could be chilled by that. you know, I think that type of a case could come up again. In that particular case, the Clapper decision found no standing, not so much on the basis of the alleged negative impact, that is to say, on the attorney-client communications, but on the fact that it was speculative whether these individuals, even though there was perhaps some reason to believe they were the subject of surveillance, there was no evidence that they were subject to surveillance, so that the harm might have been real, but it was not, it was not imminent. It was not, there was not a substantial risk of that. So it was speculative. The harm was real, but speculative. So, I think the court will ultimately get a case in this vein. Jeff, what do you think?
I agree that we are not done with this. I think that another thought experiment beyond what Judge Bork would have done is what would Spokio have looked like if Justice Scalia had still been with us. And I think that as we get a little bit of a better sense of what Justice Gorsuch thinks about these things, we may be able to predict perhaps a bit better what kinds of cases the Supreme Court might be interested in taking to flesh out this area. I think that what the privacy statutes mean, I think the impact of Spokio in class certification decisions, there are a number of very interesting issues that could percolate up that the conservative majority could do what I suspect Justice Scalia might have done. I mean, again, you look at Spokio and you realize that it was a fairly consensus decision, and you read the thing and you come away with kind of two sentences that you know Justice Alito wrote, followed by a sentence that probably was the sentence needed to preserve consensus and get an opinion out. And so it was a clear camel, horse designed by committee of a decision. And so I think that there will some way will be found to get cases up there that might yield a result that would be a little clearer than the Spokio decision turned out to be. We may have to wait a little while for it, but I it's certainly going to come.
It looks like we have time for one more question. Go ahead, caller.
Question, why are these arguments being made as standing arguments rather than as merits arguments? Because if you think to the law of negligence and you don't, you know, if a plaintiff doesn't show harm, an element fails and therefore the cause of action fails. And yet here, or if it's an intentional tort, you get nominal damages. But here, it's these claims which seem like merits claims are being brought as standing claims. And I'm curious why that is.
So that's a wonderful question, and I think that there are many statutes where you could say, particularly statutes that say that only an aggrieved consumer, and the Video Privacy Protection Act uses the word aggrieved consumer as well. There are statutes where aggrieved comes into play, and I think you could just as easily argue, not in standing but simply as a failure to state a claim, you are not aggrieved because you didn't suffer harm. I think the problem is that some of the statutes where Spokio really comes up, the Fair Credit Reporting Act, Telephone Consumer Protection Act, and others, Congress has defined the harm awfully narrowly. And it says that basically you have standing to sue simply if the phone rang, or you have standing to sue simply because this piece of information that you should have gotten was not given to you, and it defines harm as your failure to get this information. And so unfortunately, I think that although there are circumstances in which people go to the standing card when perhaps they don't need to, there are other cases where it's just as likely to be the only card they can play. Alan, what do you think?
Yeah, well, I think that firstly, in cases where under statutes where there are statutory damages, may incline a court to be more lenient on a merits dismissal under 12b-6. I think that if a case is dismissed on standing grounds, it's more difficult for a plaintiff to plead his or her way around a standing dismissal, it's jurisdictional, right? So the court is without jurisdiction and must consider standing as an initial matter. I think that, you know, if a case is dismissed on standing, and you, what you're dealing with, of course, is plaintiff's lawyers who are interested, you know, they're not interested in, you know, in dragging these cases out. If a case is dismissed early, on standing, it's, you know, they begin to lose confidence in the likelihood of class certification, of ultimately getting to discovery. So I you know, I think it's one, it's because it's it goes to the court's jurisdiction. The courts must consider it, and if standing is found to be lacking, many courts won't. Some courts will consider 12b-6 merits motions at the same time, but many will just not even go there on the grounds that as soon as they've considered standing and found it lacking, that they're without jurisdiction to analyze the issues further. But you know, I think it's a threshold matter from the standpoint of the defense. It's obviously a way of you know, getting a powerful decision early. So that's, I guess that would be my answer.
Would either of you like to make some closing remarks?
I think we've, at least from my sake, you know, this is a fascinating area. One, I think where there's consensus, certainly I would say amongst the speakers that we're going to see a lot more of these cases, and there will be greater clarity. It will likely go back up to the Supreme Court. But this is, you know, an inherently thorny area, and I'm not sure that it's not just the court, it's not just Congress, but it's society that has really not come to terms with how we all feel about some of these intangible privacy and data and informational, you know, interests that we have. So as society works these out, perhaps, then ultimately Congress and the courts will as well, perhaps.
I agree. I think that the legacy of Spokio remains still unwritten, and stay tuned.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.